Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people, in my estimation, who have a better grasp of the nature of that free world and who are chronicling it and helping shape others thinking about it better than a man who has generously agreed to give us a full hour of his time today to talk about, well, how we're doing, whether we even understand we're in such a war, let alone whether we're conducting ourselves properly to lead to our victory there. He is Michael Rubin. Dr. Rubin is currently a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, the author of countless extraordinarily insightful essays, and most recently a terrific book, Dancing with the Devil, which is all about the history of U.S. diplomacy with rogue regimes and terrorist groups. There's a lot of that going on at the moment. We'll start with that. Michael Rubin, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for this very special hour with you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Frank.
I'd like to start with a country you've spent a lot of time in. And one of the things that I've always admired about you, Michael, is that you've not only seriously studied this in an academic sense, but you've actually been a practitioner. You were working with the Coalition Provisional Authority, but not inside the Green Zone, which we'll be talking about, I'm sure, in the course of this conversation. But you got out into the countryside, including places that were pretty darn dangerous back during the effort to liberate the country and stabilize it in the last decade. Talk a little bit about where you think we are at the moment in Iraq, and give me our prognosis of where it's going from here.
Well, you know, we made our decision about what to do with regard to Iraq back in 2011 when we withdrew precipitously. There's a myth out there that the Iraqis weren't going to allow American forces to stay, so President Obama had no choice but to withdraw. That's simply a myth. When you talk to the Iraqi negotiators, they complain that the Americans wouldn't take yes for an answer. One of the greatest ironies is when Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who granted tilted to Iran, agreed to allow American forces to stay, Obama's negotiator shot back and said, no, you got to pass it through your parliament. The reason why I say that's an irony is today, when it comes to negotiating with Iran, President Obama is bending over backwards not to pass things through the United States Congress. It seems he only will pay attention to parliaments when it suits what he wants. And in the case of 2011 in Iraq, what he wanted was a complete and utter withdrawal. That's why we have the vacuum that developed and the Islamic State and Iran doing their darndest to fill that vacuum.
Yeah. And you were one of those at the time, as I recall, Michael, who warned against this, who recognized that the vacuum would be created, that instability would fill that vacuum. At best, at worst, it would be, well, the likes of the Iranians on the one hand and the al-Qaeda types now doing business as the Islamic State. Having been sadly vindicated in this, talk, if you would, about how those two competing forces are now jockeying for the filling of that vacuum and where you would put your money in terms of the future of Iraq.
Well, one of the key things to understand is that the Iraqis simply do not have a Sunni leadership. And this is one of the reasons why the Islamic State has been moving in to the degree it has into areas primarily populated by the Sunnis. You know, you can complain all you want, Frank, about Iraqi politicians, about the Nouri al-Malikis and the Haider Abadis and the Ammar al-Hakims from the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, or even Ahmad Talabi. But the fact of the matter is, when Iraqis get frustrated with their Shiite politicians, they can still rally around the Ayatollahs in Najaf. Ditto the Kurds. You can complain about their corruption, but they still have their traditional political leaders, their warlords, if you like. The Sunnis have no one, and that's why the Islamic State has been able to march right in. You have some Sunni tribes here and there, but Saddam Hussein employed a strategy of divide and conquer. You don't have any paramount tribal leaders, and this is one of the problems we have. When it comes to Iran, of course, one of the things we need to remember is not all Shiites are pro-Iranian. And lest anyone forget, remember, before the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Iran was one of our greatest allies, and they were still just as Shiite then as they are now. The problem we have in Iraq is weak. The Americans have withdrawn, and so we've undercut the ability of the Iraqi Shiites to find any balance, and therefore the Iranians come in and try to dominate, and they're not afraid to twist arms. And, I mean, take Nouri al-Maliki, the former prime minister. The only reason he was, in the end, as pro-Iranian as he was simply because he couldn't balance out the Iranian pressure with the Americans anymore, and so he had no choice but to make his accommodation. And it's not just in Iraq we see this. All throughout the region, as President Obama goes absent, all these guys are having to make their accommodation with some very, very bad people.
Let's talk about President Obama going absent. We're supposed to be back, the last time I checked, though not with boots on the ground so much, though there apparently are an awful lot of people in the embassy in Baghdad. And you spent time in, I guess, not the new embassy, Michael, but certainly in the green zone where we had our diplomatic mission in the old days. When you look at what President Obama is doing now to degrade and defeat the Islamic State, which he insists is not, of course, Islamic, and the relationship, and we'll talk more about this in the next block about Iran, but are we there or aren't we there? Are we engaging in a strategically sensible way, in your estimation, or not? And if not, is there any chance that this can come out to our advantage or even to the advantage of the Iraqi people?
Well, the answer is not, Frank. And I mean, when you talk about the huge American presence there, it's less boots on the ground than sandals at the swimming pool. That said, when you look at the Pentagon press releases, and I look at them every day, and you see a tally of 7 airstrikes, you and I both know it takes 35 seconds, every 45 seconds, a U.S. aircraft carrier can launch an F-18. So when you're talking about 7 airstrikes, in effect, you're talking about a concerted 5 minutes of aircraft carrier time, that's hardly a way to defeat and degrade ISIS. I mean, what President Obama seems to be after is more the symbolism of acting rather than the substance of acting. If he really wanted to act, there's a lot more we could be doing.
And, you know, I keep, as you say about these press reports, and again, our guest is Dr. Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute, the author most recently of Dancing with the Devil. I'm looking at what the targets of these aircraft strikes seem to be. It's an artillery piece here. It is an armored personnel carrier there. And I'm sure that that has some exceedingly narrow tactical benefit to the folks on the ground that we're trying to help. But this really doesn't even qualify as close air support. And I'm sure you heard the contest that was going on in the Pentagon recently, Michael, in the absence of a formal name for this mission to degrade and ultimately destroy the Islamic State. And the winner, at least for a time, was, "Hey, that's my Humvee." I just think, you know, this does not translate into a degree of seriousness that our enemies could respect, let alone be dissuaded from pursuing their goals in the face of.
No, and I think two things are going on interrelated. First of all, when President Obama made his announcement that he was finally going to get involved in Syria back on September 10th of this year, it came after, of course, the beheadings of American journalists. There's a great deal of popular outrage at the time. And unfortunately, it seems that President Obama, rather than seeing the strategic necessity of defeating ISIS, was simply responding to the polls, responding to the headlines. When it comes to this nature of responding to the polls, what President Obama doesn't understand is the U.S. military should never have 300 million commanders-in-chief. It should have one commander-in-chief. He's got to make decisions based on what will lead to victory, what will preserve American national security interests, not what on any particular day is going to help him as a politician at the polls.
Yeah. And I guess what screams out at you as you take this kind of pulse of the body politic on the one hand, Michael Rubin, and the president's decision-making is what seems to be a complete absence of sensible military advice, or at least sensible military advice being taken aboard and acted upon by a commander-in-chief that is clearly not up to the job. We'll talk more about that phenomenon and also our allies, as we're told they are, in this conflict with the Islamic State, and much more with Michael Rubin, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting in a very special deep drill down with one of the country's preeminent authorities on the Middle East. about what's happening there at the moment and what it might mean for you. Our guest is Dr. Michael Rubin, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, the author of numerous books, including Dancing with the Devil. And we're going to talk more in a moment about another topic of his, radical vigilantes in Khatami's Iran. But for the moment, let's just stay with what we were discussing before, Michael, and that is this president's strategy informed by military advice and counsel? And for that matter, is it good military advice and counsel? I'm reminded that he simply blithely ignored the military's recommendations about essentially banning U.S. anti-personnel landmines, which I think has terrible implications for our troops if we do put them into harm's way in the future, and we surely will.
Well, you're absolutely right, Frank, and we've seen this especially in the second-term administration, where he's surrounded himself with yes-men who aren't going to raise their voice in a debate. And so we've seen a lot of military officials come out with regard to frustration at President Obama completely ignoring their advice with regard to Syria. But when it comes to landmines, you know, I think President Obama, when he thinks about landmines, thinks about some of these Hollywood movies he may have seen. He doesn't understand, number one, the strategic importance of them, and number two, they're not simply scattered around in a way that can kill civilians. We use landmines to defend our entrenched positions. We map where they are. If you stop using landmines, the only guarantee you're going to have is that North Korea is going to start infiltrating into South Korea and that Americans are going to be killed. You don't really have innocent civilians getting killed by landmines, which Americans are using.
And that's for two reasons. One, as you say, we've got them at the most heavily mined border in the world, the demilitarized zone in Korea. And I guess they're going to stay there. There's not any talk of digging them up there. That's one good thing. But what we've also done, as you know, Michael Rubin, is we've exclusively now got landmines that self-destruct or self-deactivate at least, and therefore are not the kind of permanent blight. But there will be no end, you can be sure, of the use by others, including our enemies, of landmines against us. And the prospect of having troops like those that may wind up in Iran, or rather Iraq, exposed in this fashion is really reprehensible. We're visiting with Dr. Michael Rubin. He has been deeply involved in matters of national security policy, both as an academic but also as a practitioner for many years, and is one of the most thoughtful men in the country on these issues, it seems to me. And we're delighted to have him here for a special hour to discuss what's happening in myriad places in which American interests and even personnel are now involved. Michael Rubin, the president has made much since he announced his new strategy. Now that he has a strategy, he's told us that nations like Turkey and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia are critical pieces of its successful execution. Knowing what you do about these nations and how they have actually been involved over a long period of time with the pro-Islamist team, in fact, enabling it, underwriting it, and so on. What do you make of these so-called allies?
Well, you know, I think President Obama is tilting at windmills. Turkey has really become Pakistan on the Mediterranean. The analogy, of course, I'm drawing is that American diplomats and even Pakistani diplomats may say, oh, we're with you in the war against terrorism, and all the while Pakistan is supporting not only Taliban but al-Qaeda infiltration into Afghanistan. Well, Turkey is in a similar situation with regard to Iraq. Simply put, we wouldn't have the Islamic State in control of the broad swaths of territory it is now. We wouldn't have it as well financed. We wouldn't have it as well armed if it weren't for, at the very least, Turkey turning a blind eye, and unfortunately, in all likelihood, Turkey actively supporting the group. And this is something which President Obama simply doesn't understand. He's going to accept whatever anyone tells him. He's not going to think through and think, hey, maybe these guys are playing me. Maybe they're taking advantage of my arrogance. That's coupled, unfortunately, with gross naivete.
Let me ask you, Michael, because I think that's one possible explanation. I happen to follow a different theory, and that is that he actually isn't naive about this or deluded by people who are whispering in his ear nonsense, but that he actually is really quite sympathetic to those like Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the prime minister, now president of Turkey, and for that matter, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Qataris, and their, well, support for the Muslim Brotherhood and or other Islamists who are seeking, let's face it, the triumph of this ideology of Sharia, with which he seems to have a remarkable affinity. Weigh that possibility, would you?
Well, Frank, I mean, you've done the yeoman's work on this, and certainly that's one theory which is out there, and that could be the case. Where I would differ with you a little bit is, even if that were the case, and it very well may be, you know, President Obama isn't alone in this. We have a State Department which is woefully naive, and so if President Obama is more malicious in his intent, if he embraces these groups simply because ideologically he tends to agree with them, well, we still have the problem that if it weren't for the overwhelming naivete of the permanent U.S. bureaucracy, especially in the State Department, but perhaps to some degree in the Pentagon, we wouldn't be in the situation we are right now. In reality, if what you say is true, then President Obama is taking advantage of and contributing to a perfect storm, which frankly he couldn't simply do on his own.
Look, I don't want to excuse the State Department by any means, but I would argue that it's not just the present leadership and bureaucracy, but historically it has been deeply pro-Arabist in its outlook. And so I think you're right. He's being helped along in this regard. And he is also, needless to say, in taking counsel from Muslim Brotherhood operatives left and right, being reinforced in some of the worst of his policies in this space. Our guest again is Dr. Michael Rubin, the author most recently of a terrific book, really required reading on these subjects, entitled Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engaging Rogue Regimes. And Michael, just to sort of tie this up, do you think that the United States can safely successfully make common cause with these so-called allies at a time when, at the very best, I think it's fair to say, they're playing a double game against us. And at worst, they're actually very squarely on the other side.
You know, Frank, if we were to look at this objectively and put diplomacy aside, just base our assessment on the facts, then without doubt, both Turkey and Qatar would be and should be considered state sponsors of terrorism. And ultimately, to rely on Turkey to bring peace and stability in Syria and Iraq is like to rely on Pakistan to bring peace and stability in Afghanistan, or to rely on North Korea to bring peace and stability to South Korea.
As they say, ain't going to happen, Michael Rubin. Let me turn quickly and just for a moment, because we're going to pause again shortly. Michael, are the Kurds a very different sort of option, and should we be doing more to work with them in this space?
The Kurds most certainly are a different option, and we should be doing much more to work with them. That said, oftentimes the discussion in the United States is a little bit facile about the Kurds, because the Kurds aren't just a single entity. There's different flavors and different stripes of the Kurds, and so if we are going to maximize the impact and the benefit to U.S. national security, we need to go into it with eyes wide open and make sure that we take full advantage of what the Kurds have to offer.
There have been some who've said we ought to be supporting a sort of Kurdistan out of all of this, and there was a warning the other day from one of my colleagues, Stephen Coughlin, that that's a formula unless we're really in there in a big way for their elimination at the hands of what's left of Iraq and Iran and Turkey and Syria. And so I think your admonition about being careful is well taken. Michael Rubin, we have to pause for just a moment. We'll be back with a third block of our very special hour-long interview with Dr. Michael Rubin. We'll turn to Iran next, what they're up to and what it might mean for you right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
The utter cynicism and lawlessness of the Obama administration was telegraphed yesterday by Labor Secretary Thomas Perez. Perez, one of the frontrunners to be our next attorney general, announced that after the election, the president will take, quote, aggressive executive action, unquote, on immigration. Translation? Once American voters can no longer punish Team Obama and its partisans in Congress, millions of illegal aliens will be given legal residency status. To add insult to the injury of such a gross and unconstitutional act of presidential overreach, Secretary Perez asserted that the effect will be to bring about more, quote, shared prosperity, unquote. It would be more accurate to call it redistributed prosperity. And American voters should use the opportunity of voting this fall to make it clear that this is totally unacceptable now and after the election. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. We're talking with Dr. Michael Rubin, the author of, most recently, Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engaging Rogue Regimes. We've had a very interesting conversation over the past two blocks about the environment in which our relationship with Iran is now evolving, namely the Islamic State and its emergence in Iraq. There is some thought being given, evidently, in the Obama administration to the idea that Iran can be a counterweight to that development. We've talked about some very dubious allies of the Sunni stripe, Michael Rubin. When you talk about engaging rogue regimes, I believe you had very much in mind the perils of doing any business with Iran. Before we get to the negotiations on their nuclear weapons program, talk a little bit about the role Iran is now playing in Iraq and whether we should be encouraging it to play a bigger role and perhaps enabling it to do so.
Well, Iran is playing a hugely active role in Iraq. We shouldn't overestimate their strength, however. You know, one of the ironies is while we self-flagellate and blame ourselves for how quickly the Iraqi army collapsed in the face of the Islamic State, ever since we abandoned Iraq in 2011, the former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was replacing, purging, if you will, top professional military officers with those more politically loyal to him and, frankly, more loyal to the Islamic Republic of Iran. They had active Iranian training on the part of the Quds Force. Now, the fact that they collapsed so quickly is perhaps an indication that Iran isn't as strong as some people imagine it to be. At the same time, make no mistake, the Iranians want to fill a vacuum. They may be truly dedicated to the defeat of the Islamic State, but what they want to replace it with is not a formula for stability. They want to replace it with another flavor of terrorism, namely one modeled on Hezbollah and one just as noxious to regional security and American national security.
Michael Rubin, this is an interesting question. Do you think it's possible that the Iranians actually were very much in favor of essentially wrecking the Iraqi military as a possible counterweight to what they might have in mind for the people of Iraq, as you've just suggested?
Certainly, that's their goal. And whatever your assessment of what the Iranians are doing, one thing which is without a doubt is that Iranians went about systematically unwinding and killing those who were involved in Iraqi intelligence with the file of watching Iran and reporting on what the Iranians were doing. They didn't want any limelight shown on their activities inside Iraq, especially with regard to the Iraqi army.
Do you believe, Michael, that the Iranians have in fact been able to penetrate officially, installing their own people, as I've been told, in positions of leadership in various Iraqi government ministries, and thereby, you know, not only been able to engage in that kind of purge, as you say, but really to essentially take it over from within?
Well, let's go back to the year 2003, Frank, when I would go out to Sadr City, where you had a whole huge market, a bazaar, but instead of selling bananas and oranges and automobile parts, what it was selling was official documents. The price of Iraqi passports were going up in the market, while the price of Iranian passports were going down. And the simple fact was this: Iranians were coming in, dumping their Iranian passports and buying Iraqi ones. It was all supply and demand, and it's only gotten worse over the last decade.
Michael, let me just ask you about the bomb. The Iranians have been said for quite some time to be within a year or months, or in some cases weeks, of being able to turn the very substantial amount of fissile material that they've now been able to acquire and to enrich into a nuclear weapon. And yet we're being told by the Obama administration, notably in a speech yesterday by Undersecretary of State Wendy Sherman, who we have the unfortunate liability of having as our negotiator with the Iranians, the same woman who made a complete hash-up of the negotiations with another of the rogue regimes you've been covering, North Korea. We're being told by the administration that we're now within spitting distance, it seems, of getting a deal with the Iranians that will keep them from getting the bomb. What do you make of that?
Well, we're within spitting distance of getting a deal. But, you know, it's always been possible to make a deal with Iran. The question is whether the deal is going to actually achieve what our politicians say set out to achieve. And the answer to that is no. Obama is much more interested in reaching a bad deal than no deal at all, because he wants to constrain future American diplomacy. And in a way, he may be ideologically sympathetic to the Islamic Republic of Iran. What I think the uniting factor is he's ideologically hostile to American power and wants it checked wherever it can be checked. He doesn't understand that by so doing, he's really setting us down the path to greater conflict, not only in the Middle East, but elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, and possibly nuclear conflict at that. And again, just to dwell on this for a moment, I'm not sure whether it's sympathy for the regime per se, but it does seem to be an affinity for the Islamists. And they happen to be doing business as the government of Iran, as you know so well, Michael, under the Shiite strain of this program. But he seems equally sympathetic to them under the Sunni stripe elsewhere around that region and the world, for that matter. So, Michael, if you were to make book, is it a safe bet at this point that Iran will get the bomb? And what will that mean for the proliferation of nuclear weapons in that region? And, well, you sort of touched on it a moment ago, the likelihood that there will be quite possibly nuclear conflict erupting there and perhaps beyond.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm not sure that Iran has decided whether or not it wants to get the bomb, but this is what's dangerous, Frank. What Iran wants is a nuclear weapons capability. Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel has said that should be the red line. President Obama said, no. The red line should be actual possession of nuclear weapons. What most people don't understand is the difference between the two can be as little as a week. And we don't have the human intelligence in there to determine when Iran makes that decision.
This is such a critical point, and there are a few people probably in the West who've studied this more closely than you and written and thought about it longer. Are you really telling me that you don't think the Iranian regime has made a decision probably decades ago to acquire the nuclear capability that would enable them to wipe Israel off the map?
You're saying they're making a decision to acquire the nuclear capability, and that's where I'm agreeing with you.
No. I mean to get the bomb. To get the bomb. Let's put the fine point
on. And like I said, they want to acquire the nuclear capability. When President Obama says that he's going to prevent them from building a bomb, but he's going to allow them to create a nuclear capability, what most people don't understand is, in effect, that's one and the same thing. When the CIA says there's no proof that Iran has made the decision to build a bomb, the answer to that is, so what if they've made the decision that they're going to build all the components and all they have to do is screw A into B into C, and presto, you have a nuclear weapon. That's what we need to prevent, and that's what the Obama administration policy isn't allowing us to prevent. But if I can just go on to the second part of the question, Frank, and some people will actually say, and this is important to push back on, that even if Iran did develop a nuclear weapon, the regime isn't suicidal. These people don't understand where mutually assured destruction actually breaks down. Let's put aside, and it breaks down, of course, on this idea that Iran is motivated by anything other than ideology. Iran, first and foremost, is an ideological republic. But what happens if you have an uprising in Iran like in 2009? But in this case, instead of the Revolutionary Guard helping to put it down, portions of the security forces actually join in, so you have a situation like 1989 Ceausescu in Romania. Well, if you have a situation where the regime is collapsing, what's to stop the unit of the Revolutionary Guard, the most ideologically pure unit that is firmly dedicated to the destruction of America and Israel, from launching a nuclear weapon, knowing that the regime is going to be gone in only 12 hours or so? In a situation like that, would the United States or Israel really retaliate against an Iran which used a nuclear weapon when Iran has already had regime change? And after all, deterrence is the willingness to kill 20 million Iranians. It's also a psychological strategy. You have to convince them that you'd be willing to do this. And you know what? Back in the 2007 Democratic primary debate, then Senator Hillary Clinton said, if Iran ever used nuclear weapons, we would obliterate them. And you know who pushed back against her? Two senators, two fellow candidates. One was Joe Biden. The other one was Barack Obama. So Iran will look at that and realize, hey, this guy's never going to enforce deterrence. We can get away with murder.
We have to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Michael Rubin. He is one of the country's duty experts on matters involving the Middle East, the threats that are emerging from it, the people who are bringing those threats to us, including some, we're told, are allies, and, of course, many who are unmistakably hostile to us. Among those who are most hostile, but who have, to a considerable degree, particularly under the Obama administration, largely been given a pass, amazingly, is the Muslim Brotherhood. And Dr. Rubin, in your studies of this matter at the American Enterprise Institute, where you are a resident scholar, in your books about the perils of engaging rogue regimes entitled Dancing with the Devil, in your work on Iran, your myriad columns and articles and so on, one of the things that I think has been unmistakably true is that we were spared from a really disastrous situation by the people of Egypt,
who, having voted in the Muslim Brotherhood there as their government, essentially took to the streets to get them removed. Talk, if you would, a bit about the Brotherhood, the role it's playing today in Egypt and elsewhere in the region, the influence it's having on all of these jihadist groups, in fact, what I call the global jihadist enterprise, and the folly, if you agree, of making common cause with them, as President Obama's administration has been doing.
If we have one guiding principle to American strategy, and I don't believe we've had a coherent strategy in the region for several administrations, it would be we should roll back the Muslim Brotherhood wherever they are. Instead of second-guessing what happened in Egypt, we should be celebrating the coup against the Muslim Brotherhood. We should be pushing them back in with regard to Hamas in the Gaza Strip. We should be pushing them back with regard to President Erdogan in Turkey and so forth. Back in 1946, the U.S. intelligence community assessed that one of the greatest threats to the United States would not only be communism, but also Islamic fundamentalism. And as their evidence, they cited what the Muslim Brotherhood was doing, engaging in ideological terrorism. And we need to remember, this is before the partition of Palestine. This is before the creation of the State of Israel. Islamic terrorism predates that. And we need to recognize that the Muslim Brotherhood ain't some Christian Democratic Party from Europe. It's dedicated to the eradication of Western civilization.
And it makes that point explicit in its writings and in its public positions, and not least, of course, the secret plan we tumbled upon providentially in Annandale, Virginia, which says their purpose is, here in North America, destroying Western civilization from within by our own hands. It's just mind-boggling that we're not following the course you've just described. Egypt is trying to, Michael Rubin. Tell us how you think they're doing, the regime of al-Sisi.
Well, I think Sisi is doing a very good job. He's much more popular in Egypt than many Western observers might have expected, given all the tension in Egyptian society. That said, if you want my honest concerns about Sisi, look, the reason why we had this uprising in the first place was because of the kleptocracy in Egypt and because of Mubarak's poor management of the economy, which admittedly was expanding, but not in a way that was necessarily healthy. What I'm hoping is that Sisi is able to keep his grip on power and fight the fight against the Muslim Brotherhood, while at the same time recognizing that he's got to stay independent from some of his former colleagues in the military whose interests might be more selfish than putting Egypt on a much more stable foundation with a solid middle class.
He seems to be a man on borrowed time, doesn't he, Michael? If it weren't for the subventions from Saudi Arabia, notably, and I guess some of the other Gulf states, not Qatar, which has been, of course, promoting and supporting and enabling the Muslim Brotherhood everywhere, but these other Gulf states, is it likely that he would have survived this long, given the kind of economic strains on his country and the ferment, really, of his people?
No, you're absolutely right. Egypt is a country that subsidizes fuel, subsidizes bread. What worries me most is when people do polling or just compile what everyone is saying on Twitter and Facebook. This is a country where the overwhelming majority, 90% plus, think that the government should guarantee jobs, should guarantee salaries, should guarantee housing, should guarantee the price of foodstuffs in the market. You know, state-centered socialism isn't the way to lead Egypt into the future. It's not a way to put it on a solid foundation. That's going to be ultimately Sisi's greatest challenge, and it was, frankly, a challenge which Morsi demonstrated that he wasn't up to.
Let me segue to a particular place where the challenge is evident in terms of a violent conflict with Muslim Brotherhood and other jihadist elements, and that is Sinai. And I want to ask you to reflect on what's happening there, Michael, from both the Egyptian perspective and from the other side of Sinai, Israel. And you mentioned Hamas and Gaza. Israel has just, of course, fought a war there. They've been contending with threats from Sinai now. Give us a flavor of what Israel's situation is as it relates to these various threats from these quarters, as well as Hezbollah in Lebanon and perhaps Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State in the Golan and maybe in Jordan ultimately.
Well, you know, I attended President Mubarak's political party conference back in 2006, Frank. And what was amazing to me then is that a panel on housing and water and infrastructure, people in the Sinai were complaining to the point, even within his own party, that they were getting their microphone silenced, they were getting kicked out of the hallway. People in Sinai have always felt dispossessed. At the same time, they feel that they're treated as second-class citizens. And at the same time to that, they're listening to Saudi television rather than the Egyptian television. It's no surprise, therefore, that they're radicalizing in a way far more extreme than mainstream Egyptian society. Under President Morsi, he actually encouraged, if you will, the instability and insecurity in the Sinai, allowed these al-Qaeda-affiliated groups to take root, because he thought it would be useful with regard to defeating Israel and supporting Hamas. Sisi has been trying to crack down on that. Unfortunately, we have people in the U.S. Senate who can't see the big picture, people like Senator Leahy. If you go to Fort Hood, you still see the helicopters that we had promised to Egypt sitting on the tarmac at Fort Hood because Leahy has put a hold on them. They're not there to suppress demonstrators in Cairo. They couldn't be used for that. They're there to fight al-Qaeda. And unfortunately, the U.S. Senate is tying Egypt's hands in doing this. And if we don't fight al-Qaeda in the Sinai Peninsula and elsewhere, we're going to be fighting it in the streets of Washington and New York.
Yeah, well, and it's not even really the United States Senate, as you say. I think it's a single senator of a very dubious political stripe, Pat Leahy. Just dwell with me for a moment on Israel. We're looking at governments in the United Kingdom and Sweden and perhaps elsewhere endorsing the idea of Palestinian statehood. As I mentioned, Michael Rubin, we have sort of a growing circle of threats, 100,000 missiles and rockets aimed at Israel, now able to range the entire country. What's the future of the Jewish state as you see it in this environment?
You know, they're going to have to rely on themselves. They can't trust the Obama administration to prevent a deluge of chaos. We saw Secretary of State John Kerry, for example, say that the reason why the Islamic State is recruiting is because of Israel. You know, that's nonsense. And one Israeli minister responded saying, you know, when an Islamic radical beheads a Christian, someone will find a way to blame the Jews. And now the State Department's demanding an apology. But, you know, the Israeli minister was exactly right on that. The Islamic State is about the ideology of restoring the caliphate. It has nothing to do with Israel. Granted, it wants Israel's destruction. But it has also said that it's not going to stop fighting until the black flag of al-Qaeda is over Buckingham Palace and the White House as well. We've got to stop fooling ourselves thinking that this is all about grievance and that therefore with a peace process or diplomatic concessions, we can make it go away. This is very much about an ideology that has to be defeated everywhere where it exists.
Well said. The very, very well advocated thesis of your book, Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engaging Rogue Regime. Dr. Michael Rubin, I can't tell you how appreciative I am for your time today, as well as for all the work you do at the American Enterprise Institute and elsewhere, including for our government in so many advisory roles. Keep it up, please. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon, and I hope the rest of you will come back to us again Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.